This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
We have spent the better part of the last 4 years talking about the forgotten heroes who played the games we love to watch. As we get deeper into the holiday season of this crazy year, 2020, perhaps it's time we talk about someone who figured out a way to talk about the stars of the game and yet use his platform to make a difference and give back as well. Stay tuned for a special edition of Sports Forgotten Heroes and a discussion about a terrific sports writer, Jerry Eisenberg.
This is Sports Forgotten Heroes, a tribute to the stars who shape the games we love to watch and the games we love to play. Stars who provided us with many thrills, but when their time was up, they faded away. We'll take a look back at their spectacular careers, their moments of fame, even if it was just for one season or just one game. And now, here's your host, Warren Rogan.
Hello and welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes, episode number 95, Jerry Eisenberg. For those of you who know Jerry and read his coverage of sports, watched his documentaries, or read his books, you don't need much of an introduction to whom Jerry is. But for those of you who haven't or have never heard of Jerry, here's a little more about him. Jerry's career as a newspaper reporter and a columnist spans generations. From the early 1950s to the present day, he has written about championship teams and Olympic icons, baseball and football superstars, and boxing legends. Along the way, he became one of the best American sports columnists. Until Super Bowl 54, Jerry was one of two men, the other being Jerry Green, who attended every Super Bowl in person. But for Super Bowl 54, he watched the game and reported on it from home. And impressively, not only did he predict the Kansas City Chiefs would win, he predicted the final score as well, 31-20. Another sport Jerry loved to cover was the Triple Crown, and his coverage of the sport was prolific. In fact, no matter what Jerry wrote about, in the end, his coverage of it was, well, prolific. His love for his craft, his attention to detail was, and still is, second to none. And how he was able to take advantage of his position as a writer to give back and right wrongs is truly remarkable. And I'm going to get into a lot of it with Ed Odovan, who just released a new ebook called Going 15 Rounds with Jerry Eisenberg. Now, before we get to my conversation with Ed, a few notes. I love this podcast. It's a hobby, a passion. It's not my day job. I actually have to work for a living, and my work takes me on the road quite often. So, this episode of Sports Forgotten Heroes was recorded over Zoom in my hotel room. So the audio, while perfectly, well, audible, is not exactly as crisp as we're all used to. Add to that, I did record the conversation with Ed over Zoom, and he was in his place in Tokyo. But again, you should have no issues understanding or hearing any of it. But I did want to bring that to your attention. Also, as always, please follow Sports Forgotten Heroes on Twitter at SportsFHeroes. Look for Sports Forgotten Heroes on Instagram or the Sports Forgotten Heroes page on Facebook. And of course, you can always go to sportsfh.com to learn more about my guests, the forgotten stars I talk about. Ask questions, make suggestions, or just let me know how I'm doing. Again, that's sportsfh.com. And as always, thanks for your support. One more note for you. Sports Forgotten Heroes is now a part of the Sports History Network, a bunch of us sports history aficionados have teamed up so you can now find podcasts about all sorts of sports history in one place, and that's SportsHistoryNetwork.com. Again, SportsHistoryNetwork.com. Okay, without further ado, let's get to today's show about Jerry Eisenberg with my guest, Ed Odom. Ed, thanks for hunting me down and joining me on Sports Forgotten Heroes. So glad you could be here.
Thank you very much, Warren. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Awesome. Hey, you know, Jerry Eisenberg is not, at least to me, is not as much a forgotten sports personality as he is, I think, more a personality whom so many don't know or who have never known. And it's a shame because his work is really second to none, a longtime columnist for the Newark Star-Ledger, an author, a producer, a director, a writer, a true sports treasure. So let me ask you this. What was your motivation to write a book about Jerry Eisenberg?
You know, Jerry is, in my opinion, a prolific storyteller and just an institution within sports. And I wanted to kind of find out what made him tick over the years, what made him have the passion to do his job so well, going back to the 1950s. And I wanted to learn about his career through his eyes, which is actually the intro to his memoir written several years ago. But I also wanted to learn like how he saw the sports world, how he approached his job, how he stayed interested in everything, not just the winners, but the losers and the trends within sports, and how he viewed sports as a microcosm of society.
For those that don't know him, who is Jerry Eisenberg?
Okay, Jerry Eisenberg is a journalist who has covered every Super Bowl, and there have only been two newspaper columnists who have done so. Jerry Green of the Detroit News and Jerry Eisenberg of the Star-Ledger. But this year was the first year he covered the Super Bowl away from the venue. He actually watched it from a Las Vegas sports book. So he actually ended his streak of attending every Super Bowl in person. So he turned 90 years old in September. So yes, he's a longtime sports journalist, but he's also just a person who is always interested in the craft of writing stories and telling stories. He published his first novel at age 90 just a couple of weeks ago. And he's been semi-retired for 12, 13 years now, but he still is covering, like I said, the Super Bowl, major boxing fights, the Triple Crown horse races. He writes remembrances on prominent people when they pass away or are issues that he thinks need to be a stand taken on. So he's a guy that remains interested in the world of sports. But you go back decades before, he joined the Star-Ledger for the his continuous arc of his career in 1962. But he had started there in 51 as a college student. So think, who do you know who's been working in journalism since 1951? Anybody else?
I can't think of anybody right off the bat, no.
Okay, so what's also neat about his career is he was a young reporter at the old New York Herald Tribune, which is no longer in existence, but a paper that really had some great writers like Jimmy Breslin and Dick Schaap. Red Smith used to write a column there, and Jerry Eisenberg's desk in the office, I don't know how often he was actually in the office, either of them, but his desk was actually next to Red Smith.
Wow. And
his sports editor, Stanley Woodward, who worked at both the Star-Ledger and the Herald Tribune, was considered by many the greatest sports editor of all time. He was the guy who mentored Jerry. So there's a pipeline of people going back to the beginning of the 19th of the 20th century who were important in his career. And, you know, he covered like, he knew Vince Lombardi very well, dating back to when he was with the New York Giants and when he was at Fordham University. And he knew Pete Rozelle very well, the author of one of his books. So he had a real connection to people from the old school, but he's really tight with Manny Pacquiao and with Freddie Roach, that boxing, you know, the boxer trainer tandem. So he's very relevant to this day.
You know, when you consider sports writing, you think of names like the late Dave Anderson or Red Smith or Jim Murray, Shirley Povich, Jimmy Cannon. The list goes on and on. I mean, there have been, you know, these phenomenal, phenomenal sports writers whom we can roll off the tip of our tongues like I just did. Mm-hmm. These are the names of sports reporters many in our audience might recognize, but not everyone might recognize the name of Jerry Eisenberg. Why do you suppose that is, and what made his writing, his style, stand out?
Okay, well, I think the national distribution of the Newark Star-Ledger just didn't have the coast-to-coast market of some of the other papers like the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune in its heyday or the LA Times where Jim Murray worked. But for decades, Jerry's column was syndicated in small newspapers across the country and some bigger papers. So people may recognize his name, but it might have, you know, fallen off their memory banks because of just the overexposure of other people. But, you know, he was really good friends with Jim Murray and Dave Anderson and some of these other guys. You know, Dave Anderson really spoke highly of him in a chapter of the book that I wrote and really admired his writing, and others as well, like John Shulian, who went on to produce what was it, Xena the Warrior Princess? Am I saying that right?
I think so.
He has great admiration for Jerry. And what I learned and what I appreciated in reading his work in my younger days and once I graduated college and became a full-time journalist, Jerry is a great storyteller with a knack for details and the ability, like Ernest Hemingway, to write succinctly and to give you a point. And he can get into flowery prose and write a 90-word sentence, 150 words, something that Jimmy Breslin really, you know, told people not to do. But Jerry was just a great storyteller, and he found angles and he found nuggets of information that carried a story. It wasn't about all the statistics, like like top to bottom of analytics and overdoing that. He knew how to talk to people, knew how to get them to say stuff that was interesting, develop relationships with them. Those were among his greatest skills.
Ed, during all the interviews that you did, and you interviewed a lot of people, what surprised you most about Jerry? What did you learn about Jerry Eisenberg that made you go, wow?
Okay. I guess I realized he was a hard worker and he was prolific. Maybe those are hand in hand. But I guess that one of the things that was a recurring theme with everybody, from Dave Anderson to Ira Burkow to John Shulian, I didn't mention Wallace Matthews, but he also repeated these same kind of thoughts. And he's decades younger than Jerry, and also Jeremy Schapp, who's also, you know, many years younger. They all said that he just has a passion that never dies out. He's always looking for the next story. And he always has like five or six ideas that are in the back of his mind that are, you know, he's thinking about what he wants to do even before he finishes what he's doing now. So to me, that's inspiring in my own career, working for Japan Forward and previous outlets before, where I want to be motivated to continue to strive for excellence in whatever I'm writing or reporting.
How did his fellow writers treat him? What kind of respect did they give him? And by the way, let's just, we are recording this podcast. Today is November 18th, 2020. And when I speak of Jerry in the past tense, it's sort of not exactly correct because Jerry's still with us.
Yeah, that's a good point to make. And I try to read every one of his columns that comes out now. I find his work relevant, as relevant now as what he was writing in the 80s and in the 60s and in between. You know, decades ago, he also did a lot of magazine work. So it's a treat to go back and read some of those things as well. He just has a, he's kind of like a painter where he just has a style. You know, he paints paints a picture with words, I should say. And sometimes just a really obscure word will come out of nowhere, but you look at it and you say, that's the perfect word or that's the perfect phrase to use in that situation.
How did his fellow writers, I mean, how do his fellow writers, I mean, how, what kind of respect does he have from everybody in the industry? And how did, you know, even the guys that have since passed on, how did they all respect him and treat him? What did they all think of Jerry Eisenberg?
Okay. Let me mention a couple names of people that also were interviewed that kind of explain that point. Edwin Pope of the Miami Herald. I got to speak to him very briefly a couple years ago. I think it was 2017, right before he passed away. And he was having trouble hearing, so I kept the interview really short. But he said, like, I met Jerry for the first time in the late 1950s. And you just look at his writing, and he just, I respect it. He put pride into his work, and he was a great storyteller. And he respected the English language, you know, to not just write in a way that was pompous or arrogant, but to get right in a way that people could appreciate the craft and the structure of the sentences and the paragraphs. A couple other people that that really, I guess, hammered home on that point a bit more. Ira Burkow was a Pulitzer Prize winner at the New York Times. He's also semi-retired, but he's about a decade younger than Jerry. And he said, like, you know, when I'm that age, you know, I probably still want to write a little bit, but I really admire that he's always thinking about new projects and that he takes pride in his work. People say, like, yeah, his work ethic was second to none, but also he had the respect of people around the leagues that he covered, around the institutions of sports, like the boxing gyms, like the horse racing barns. Like, he may write a column they don't like one day, but he's back out there the next day. And these are his opinions based on facts. So he does the work, he digs in, you know, finds the facts. That was something that really was, you know, came up again and again and again. And George Foreman, you know, he just said, yeah, Jerry is a good guy, and he, you know, he's around. We always saw him, and he always asked us questions. He was always curious. So I think that's something that other people said as well, that many people said, I should say.
Well, let's talk about a couple of the writers he considered mentors. Let's start with Shirley Povich. Why Shirley? Why did he consider Shirley Povich a mentor? And by the way, you cannot end the discussion about Shirley without telling us the story that you relayed in your book about the warning Shirley gave to a certain person from the mob about an impending raid of his restaurant. It was a very fun story to read.
Okay.
But first tell Shirley, us why, you know, Jerry considered him a mentor.
He considered him a mentor because he was a gentleman in a profession where honesty is not necessarily always, you know, embraced, where in the old days, like, promoters might, you know, want to give you some money under the table, or might want to bribe you to write something to promote something in a certain way. And Jerry is considered, Shirley Poe was an honest guy and a guy who always reported the facts and did not want to be influenced by someone outside of his, by anybody. He just wanted to do the job and do it to the best of his ability. And like Jerry, he also had a heck of a long career. Into his late 90s, he was still writing a column for the Washington Post. And if I remember correctly, the home run chase between Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire, possibly his last column was sort of a recollection of the way that the media and the way he even wrote about Roger Maris and Babe Ruth in those years when they were setting their records in 61 for Roger and 1927 for the Babe.
That's fun. Tell us about Shirley Povich and the mobster that he gave a warning to, if you remember the story and if you can relay it to us.
Okay. I need to brush up on the tone setting of it to make it into a mini play. But in one example of the way Jerry talked about the honesty and the ethics, the journalism ethics of Shirley Povich, he sometimes knew people from the mob, and you know, people that were connected to horse racing and boxing and baseball and such, as was very common back in the earlier part of the 20th century. And at one of these visits to so he was visiting Detroit, Shirley Povich was, and he entered into a a bar, and he saw one of the mobsters there, and Shirley told the guy, I hear they're going to raid your place for gambling. So I think you should clean it up, right? Yeah. And the guy wanted to pay him back, give him something in return. And he said, no, I can't accept anything.
So and he tried on several occasions to give him something.
Yeah. Like, I think he was going to, he offered him like, free booze or a fur coat or even women. I think he tried to bribe him and Shirley said, no, I'm not taking anything. You've been friendly to me. He may not agree with the guy's lifestyle or what he does, but he said, no, I'm not taking anything. I just wanted you to be aware that the FBI, the law enforcement is coming after you. Okay. So it turns out that the guy eventually did give him something. And it was sort of a joke, though, in a funny way. I can't remember how he received it. Was it in his coat pocket or on the table?
I think I'm forgetting that detail. It was an envelope or something. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so Jerry relayed the story that Shirley Povich eventually received payback from this guy, and it turned out to be a key that unlocked all the pay toilets in the city of Chicago. Which is pretty darn funny. Isn't that funny?
Very funny. Yeah. This way, Shirley, yeah. If Shirley was ever short any money, he knew where to go get some money. But of course, being the honest person that he was, he never used that key.
Right.
What about Red Smith? Tell us a little bit about Red Smith and how Jerry looked up to Red Smith, who, like you said, sat next to Jerry sat next to him early on in his career.
Okay, and actually, because Red Smith continued working until the early 80s when he passed away, Jerry knew him from the 50s and on, so for parts of four decades. So by that time, of course, Jerry was a lot more prominent. But yeah, he saw Red approach the craft in a way that he appreciated. What I mean by that is he always spoke about Red Red's use of the English language. It wasn't just about the subject, verb, and direct object, for example, but it was about, you know, having a vocabulary, learning how to use the vocabulary, learning how to write eloquently, but also simply. He said that Red gave us license to use the English language. And I guess maybe a lot of sports writers maybe approached it more like meat and potatoes.
Interesting. What about Jim Murray?
Okay. They were very good friends. And they, like Red Smith, often these guys in the old days when columnists had a lot more travel opportunities and a bigger budget, they would meet up like at the Super Bowl and at the Triple Crown races, the Kentucky Derby, Belmont Stakes, the Preakness, and they would meet up at the World Series, generally speaking. So 4, 5, 6 times a year, these guys might be around, maybe at one of the big golf events. Jerry was based in Newark and in New York, and Jim Murray in L.A. So they met up a couple times a year. Also, Jack Murphy in San Diego. They were kind of a tight posse, and a couple others, Edwin Pope, Blackie Sherrod down in Texas. But as far as Jim Murray goes, Jerry spoke about the way that Jim used his magazine work, and he wrote about movies and television early in his career, and how he kind of like described Hollywood, you know, like the storytelling, but through a visual medium. And Red brought that, Jim brought that to his newspaper columns. He sort of had a broader perspective that you might find in magazines. He took a step back from, say, the score of the game or the leading key stats, and he told stories. He spun yarns. He told jokes. But he also, Jerry said again and again that Jim's perspective was what really enticed him to respect his columns.
Sam Lacy, tell us who Sam Lacy was, why Eisenberg liked him, and how Sam stood up to racism as far as sports writers are concerned.
Okay. Sam Lacy was a African-American newspaper columnist for decades and working for African-American, Black-owned media. And his coverage of baseball dated back to the Negro Leagues and to Jackie Robinson breaking into the with the Brooklyn Dodgers in the National League. Of course, that same year, Larry Doby broke in with the Cleveland Indians, and Sam Lacy, you know, he was proud about the fact that he was a credentialed member of the Baseball Writers Association of America. He took pride in having a card and in being credentialed, but he also took pride in doing the job. And one story that illustrates his convictions and just his recognition that it was important for him to take a stand for himself and for people that followed him, I guess the precedent that might follow, right? Sam Lacy was down in New Orleans for spring training to watch Larry Doby play. And I believe this was the first year, 47. It might've been 48. It might've been 48 with the story. I'm pretty sure it was 47. And he went down to the game and, entered the gate, went up to the press gate and said, I'm here to report on Larry Doby. And the usher at the gate, you know, using all sorts of profanities and the N-word, said, I'm not letting you into that stadium. Well, you know, that was not what Stan wanted to hear. That was not what he accepted. And he said, well, I have a job to do. You know, this guy is the first Black player in the American League. It's my job to write about him. And the guy said, you know, he wouldn't take no for an answer. And then the guy, I guess, just wanted to get rid of him. It said something to the effect of, fine, you go sit on the roof up there. So Sam Lacy took a folding chair and walked up. It might have been a ladder even, right? Like connected to the like upper level. And he set up his own one-man press box on the roof and did his job. And sometime during that game, I don't know where the word, I guess somebody might have been just spot looking around and maybe they were walking to get a drink and they somehow spotted somebody on the roof. I'm not sure of that detail, but somehow a group of three or four white sports reporters found out that Sam Lacy was on the roof and they left the press box and went up and joined him. And they had been based in Florida for other spring training events. And they went up on the roof and took chairs and sat with him in a rare show of solidarity, probably at this point in time, in a sort of a significant moment in civil rights history. And one of those white sports reporters said to Sam, we're here to work on our tan. And I guess it was sort of a way of breaking the ice to joke about it, but they had already been in Florida for several weeks and they already had a tan. Like they had gotten plenty of sun already, but they probably respected this guy that he was so willing to go to any means to do his job. And, this story was brought up in the book, Going 15 Rounds with Jerry Eisenberg, because he really focused on race and civil rights throughout his career.
Sure. And we're going to get into some more of that. And before we do get into more about Jerry, you know, one of the things that struck me when I was reading your book, Going 15 Rounds with Jerry Eisenberg, and, you know, what an apropos title. I think why he was such a great writer and what made his writing even better was the human aspect to it, sort of something like what you said just a little while ago about Jim Murray. What I mean by that is this. He was able to make his writing more than just about sport. You really learned something when you read his column. I mean, he established a relationship with the stars he covered, a la Muhammad Ali. And he established a relationship with those who read him religiously every single day. Can you talk about that?
I think to him, exploring the human condition, so to speak, is as interesting as how the game or the tournament or the season unfolded. He sort of used that as a prism into describing what a team or what an individual went through, how they lived their life, how they overcame obstacles, how they dealt with institutional racism decades ago, how they dealt with overcoming cancer, for example, or growing up in poverty. He found an angle that was about their human condition. And one other thing that I think he did, and he was given license to do, and it was wise that they did it, but the Star-Ledger sort of allowed him to be an activist through his column and allowed him to take a stand. And what he wanted to say, he had a platform to say. And the Star-Ledger is a statewide newspaper, which used to have a circulation on Sundays, I think, of several hundred thousand. So
it was it was just over 1 million on the weekends and over 600,000 on the weekdays.
Yeah. So his column was syndicated around the country for many years, but his hardcore readers, you know, English teachers, like in, New Jersey high schools, generations of fathers and sons, you know, would read his columns and talk about like the baseball and the stories he told, from the Newark Bears to like the Joe Torre Yankees. They had a commonality in the way he wrote about the past, but connected it to the present. And he made every story relevant to something beyond the statistics. And a lot of sports reporters and columnists are really basic, right? They don't go beyond like what happens on the field.
Exactly. Exactly. And like you said, he was able to use his column to promote equality. And it wasn't fake. Mm. He really did it. And here's a great story about it. You have a great story about it. So let me just set it up this way. What kind of influence did Jerry have by virtue of his writing? And what I'm referring to is his handling of Eno Slaughter, the St. Louis Cardinals, Ford Frick, and Jackie Robinson. Please share with us what happened and how Jerry's involvement helped curb something that had the potential to really stain baseball.
Time out a second, okay? That was actually Stanley Woodward calling up saying he was going to write a column.
Oh, okay. So I misunderstood that. Well, then let's go with this.
But I will follow up on that by saying this showed, when we talk about mentors, Stanley Woodward had a moral compass that really impacted Jerry. He saw that Woodward did this. He took a stand and used the power of the press to say, I'm going to write this if you don't do this. So he was telling Ford Frick, if you don't stop this racism from happening, I'm going to get this published in the magazine. And, you are going to be, he bribed him. He said, if you do this, you'll be credited for stopping this other thing. Otherwise, he was just going to bash the heck out of him, right?
Right, exactly. Exactly.
But Jerry, okay, so this was, Jerry had worked in the 1950s, in the early 50s, he had worked under Woodward at the Star Ledger. Then a couple years later, Woodward went over to the New York Herald Tribune, and Jerry was there from, I think, 58 until 61. And Woodward actually groomed him to be a columnist, and he told him, you need to take the job at the Star Ledger. You're ready to be the guy. And one of the stories about being the guy was the fact that the job of a columnist is to take a stand when it is necessary to take a stand.
Well, I think that Jerry really did that, and it was more than just his words. His actions also spoke to that. We're going to get into that in just a bit.
Okay.
But his voice was really that for equality, civil rights, blacks, Jews, minorities. What laid the groundwork for that outlook on life, and how did he use his column to express his views and make sure his voice was heard? And I guess I'm sort of prefacing all that with he wanted to do something different, wanted to write about something different, and I forget the circumstances that led to all of it, but he was going to go, he was assigned, he wanted to do this, and they said, go cover Florida A&M football, and he said, no, I want to go to Eddie Robinson and Grambling. Tell us about that experience.
Okay. Roger Kahn, who passed away earlier this year, correct?
It might have been this year, yes.
It might have been late last year. I think it was around February. Roger Kahn was the sports editor at Saturday Evening Post, I want to say. And
he passed away in February of 2020.
Okay.
Yeah, so early this year.
He was a magazine sports editor, and him and Jerry were discussing college football projects and assignments. And Jerry wanted to, Roger wanted him to go down and do a Florida A&M story about a traditionally a school with a lot of black players, a historically black college. And Jerry said, like, well, that story's been done. People know about that school. People are aware of that story, aware of where that team is located. It sort of had a lot of coverage previously by other people. And he said, I think I should go to Grambling in Louisiana. This is a school that is getting all these players drafted, all these talented players, being followed by the scouts. But why? What is going on here? Why is this a pipeline? I think I should go there and explore this story. And he convinced Khan that this was what he should do. And he went to Grambling, and he actually stayed on campus for days. And he was the first white reporter to visit the school and to be with the football team. And he stayed in the dormitories. He ate breakfast with the players in the cafeteria. This was a way of him enmeshing himself with everybody. And in fact, he also worked on a documentary about the program while he was there. So he was doing multiple hats, wearing multiple hats at the same time. And
he said he was really able to understand what it was like for a black person, because when he walked into the cafeteria, like you said, he was the only white person on campus. And mm-hmm. when he walked into the cafeteria and everybody looked at him, all of a sudden he had traded places, and he knew, he felt, at least he thinks, he felt what mm-hmm. it was like to be in their shoes. And that led to so much more about his life.
You know, what became interesting and became relevant, and this is a common thread throughout Jerry's career with other people, from his first visit to Eddie Robinson's campus, Grambling, until he passed away, they became good friends. He visited Grambling many, many times. And in fact, the week of his final game in the late 90s, Jerry was back on campus paying his respects.
And when he first met Eddie, didn't he say that Eddie was a little reserved and really wanted to see what this Jerry Eisenberg was all about and why he wanted to come down here? You know, what was his agenda? And it turned out he really didn't have an agenda except to find out more about the school and why Eddie Robinson was able to produce this pipeline of players to the NFL. That was truly why he was there. And of course, it expanded into something else, but there was no other agenda.
No, it wasn't about promoting Jerry and what the work he was doing. It was about promoting a great story and opening the eyes of America that there are great athletes that are at this school. The coach is a great father figure, a great role model. The focus is on education and athletics. And a lot of these players are going to become the greats that you're going to know about in the years and decades to come. And he was so far ahead of the curve in identifying that as an important story that people forget about he saw this story and it was ignored by hundreds of other journalists.
Yeah.
Thousands.
And like I said before, his actions really spoke louder than words. And he really acted upon his beliefs, did Jerry. In fact, he even organized a yearly football game called the Pride Bowl. Part of his Project Pride initiative. What was it? Who did it benefit? And how did he pull it off?
Okay. This game was played for 30 years. So, and think of the difficulty in getting sponsors and getting scholarship money for anything for 30 consecutive years. You know, there's downturns in the economy, businesses shut down, businesses move, people move and pass away. So to find contributors to fund scholarships and to fund academic programs, that's what the money went for, was for after school programs in a very impoverished area, Newark, New Jersey. He used proceeds from the game to fund scholarships for hundreds of students over the years. People that became, people that went to Ivy League schools became doctors and engineers and lawyers and teachers, all different kinds of jobs that benefited society. So they sold game programs and, they sold tickets for the games. And those things also were sort of the driving force of funding for Project Pride. It was a NPO that he established in the 1970s. And it was a way of looking back on what the city had become after the riots in 1967. And a lot of the inner city, really was damaged greatly. Fires and, buildings were destroyed and people moved out. The economic downturn was really significant. And it took decades to really start to see it turning around. And this was his way of giving back to his hometown. Jerry grew up and lived in Newark his entire childhood and lived and worked there for most of his adult life.
You know, one of the amazing things about Jerry is he was able to accomplish so much as a writer when it came to these types of social issues and inequality. And people still read his column. It was a sports column. And he, like I said, he did so much. Another significant issue he covered was that of Bob Voorhees. He wrote a column about Voorhees' death, at VMI, which is now known as Virginia Tech. Jerry's column might have been the catalyst for an out-of-court settlement. Tell us about Bob Voorhees. What happened to Bob Voorhees? Why Jerry got involved? And what ultimately happened?
Years and years ago, Bob Voorhees was a college football player at, like you said, VMI. And he was practicing on the field one day. And through exhaustion and through dehydration and through his health condition, he dropped dead on the field. And the school tried, the athletic department tried to cover it up. Tried to not let the facts get out. Wasn't fear of lawsuits. So Jerry was well aware of Voorhees' background and high school career. And I'm guessing he followed him to VMI a little bit. He was on the periphery with stories that he might write about, but the tragedy of his death, struck a chord with him. And he used the power of the press, the power of the column to take a stand. He wrote about the problems of the way this was handled and the way they're practicing probably too much, right? At the time, from out of the blue, nothing to extreme volume of practice. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like there wasn't a gradual curve with the way this was handled in the start of that college football training program. And he actually wrote about this issue for 5 consecutive columns over 5 days. So the impact of that issue was really hammered home. And he took them, he didn't let it slip away. It wasn't a one-off. It was continued and continued and continued. And I should go back and read those 5 things and get back to you even again and tell you what is the takeaway from each of those 5 columns? Like what is different about part 1 to part 5 and how he wrote it. But what is significant about that is this is a college in Virginia. The newspaper is in New Jersey. So the geographical distance is big enough that most papers will probably say, okay, do it once and that's enough, right? You've got other things you can focus on, the New York area. But his editors and the publisher and the publishing family, the Newhouse family, they said, you know, they gave him the liberty to write what he thought was important. And eventually the mother did receive a settlement, did get some money from the school. I'm sorry, I don't have the figure in front of me, but
it was like 1.4 million. No, I'm sorry. That's what they were going after. It was an undisclosed out of court settlement.
Right.
If I remember correctly, I don't recall what they got, but they were, go ahead.
Okay. I think what might be significant about this story also is that generally speaking, these kind of things would have gotten swept under the rug and nobody in the public would have learned about it. And the fact that this case was brought to the forefront, it probably helped other cases that, you know, in the future, and programs had to be held to a higher level. You know, like you got to, players' health and safety has to be more important than winning football games. I think that's one of the takeaways. And also just the way the school's immoral handling of the situation.
Now, let's go back to his writing for a second, because in order to take up these kinds of issues and to write effectively about them, and to take a stand and to be good at what you do, which he was better than good. He was phenomenal, or is phenomenal. How important was the command of the English language, proper grammar, to Jerry? And what role, here's a fun one for you, what role did music play in his ability to write so eloquently? So, command of the English language, proper grammar, and what role does music play, or did music play, in his ability to write so eloquently?
Okay, I like the question. Command of the English language is huge, because for Jerry, the power of narrative and you know, the proper words and verbs that really carry a sentence, those are things that the influence of Ernest Hemingway really affected how he approached his job. You know, Hemingway has been dead since the 1960s, but his influence on writers of this generation who are maybe 20 years old now, I don't think people know quite much about Ernest Hemingway, but it was all about this short declarative sentence. And, you know, books like Old Man and the Sea are really eloquent examples of that. Just, you just tell people what's going on, and you don't have to get into 97 word sentences. I think that's part of it. Definitely a part of it.
What about music?
But as far as grammar goes, before that, you know, if you cannot structure the sentence properly, it ruptures the syntax. It really just interrupts the flow. And Jerry spoke about guys that like Jim Murray, and Hemingway was such a great stylist, but he knew how to use the language to carry a story. And decades ago, when Jerry was teaching part-time at the New School in New York, he actually relayed this point to one of his students, who gave him like a 100-word intro paragraph. And he said to one of the students, you know, the Bible in Genesis talks about God created the earth in 7 days. And, you say like one thing and then you move on to the next thing. It's like, what was it? And God saw that it was good, or that kind of sentence. That's all you need to say.
Sure. And music?
As a young guy, late teenager, around age 20. Jerry used to visit Harlem on the weekends, go up from New Jersey, uptown Harlem, North Manhattan. And he would play in some of the jazz clubs on weekends. This is an era when jazz, like around 1949, 1950, when jazz was still really, really big, you know, before rock and roll. So you think of jazz and big band and swing maybe as really prominent forms of music at that time, pop music. And Jerry played 7 or 8 instruments. He wow. wasn't an expert.
Wow.
He wasn't great at any of them, but he had proficiency to play all of them, like the trumpet, the trombone, the saxophone. He could do a little bit of everything. I don't think the drums, though. I think like the things you hold in your hand, the instrument. And a couple times he would sometimes join these like improvisational concerts and or just join like a live event and free flowing kind of like they allow a few people to get in right with the band. And one time they were short of a person and they asked him to join in. I think he had a saxophone that no, he had a clarinet that day, if I remember correctly. And so he goes on the stage and the guy hands him the sheet music for whatever song they're going to play. And Jerry said, I play it by ear. I don't read music. But so I don't know how long they were going on, maybe 15 minutes, maybe 20. They started playing a few songs. And then whatever reason, their set became the time when he would have a solo, an opportunity to showcase his skills, right? And so maybe the drum stopped, maybe the guitar stopped, maybe the trombone, maybe it was like a sequential thing. But it's Jerry's turn to go solo for a few minutes at a club on a weekend night, maybe a pretty large crowd if you consider the time period in American history. Jazz was pretty damn big at that time. And I guess he just got stage fright. He froze up and said, he lost confidence and lost concentration and like really, he got through the song, he said, but he really just struggled to even like stay focused and thought he did a terrible job. And he got really nervous and said, and later on he said afterward, like, I might have musical aptitude, but I can't do this as a career. I can't be like I was a budding musician, but I can't really make a living getting paid to play live. Maybe I could do like weddings and bar mitzvahs and birthday parties, like it's a small country club, but this isn't the career for me. But so he saw what he had ability to do, which was actually play, but enough of an ability, but he saw that he didn't have the bottle to really stay focused. It got to his nerves, but what he learned from that was using music, how it connects to literature, how it connects to the written word, and how there are pauses and how there's a rhythm to how the sound goes through the instrument to the eardrum, and how people like how jazz has a certain sound to it, right? Or how rock and roll has a certain pace and a speed. And one thing that makes him an interesting study of literature and sports too, is how there's a rhythm to his writing, and certain words and certain phrases are sort of like a musical phrase.
And interesting, interesting.
He uses the ellipses as kind of a pause. Like you would have a pause in music.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But with the ellipses in the column, he also said that he's using this as a way to get people to connect the ideas in their own mind. Like, oh, wait a second, the writer is telling me this phrase and what happens next is really part of a broader point. It's not a new paragraph or a new sentence. This is a kind of a continuing stream of what's going on.
Uh-huh. Interesting. You know, Ed, I think to be a good writer, it doesn't matter what your topic is, whether it's news or sports, politics, whatever, but to be good, even great at what you do, you have to be honest. You need to be trusted so you can get the good story, that when the person you're writing about or whom you want to write about, when you show up to write about that person, they trust you. They don't say, yeah, I better not say that around this guy. You know, I don't know what he's going to do. You have to be trusted. And that leads me to this. Tell us about Jerry's relationship or his friendship, his camaraderie with Muhammad Ali.
Okay. Well, as you saw with the book cover, Muhammad Ali is a central figure in Jerry's life. And I thought it was a way of tying in everything together is, this is a man who passed away in 2016. And if you do a poll of people, if you do a scientific poll or even a unscientific poll, and you say, if you give people like five choices, name the best column that was written in remembrance about Jerry, about Muhammad Ali, I think that the top vote you'll get will be Jerry's column that he wrote in June of 2016 when Muhammad passed away. And part of the reason is the column was epic in its length. I think it was close to 3,000 words, but also it touched upon decades of a friendship that had began when both men were younger, a lot younger. Jerry wasn't a nationally known columnist when they first met, but he was already well established in his career. They actually first met at the Rome Olympics in 1960. I think when Muhammad Ali, then Cassius Clay, you know, was walking around the Olympic Village and kind of just hamming it up, you know, he was in awe of his own celebrity and in awe of being recognized. And, you know, Jerry was observing Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, at that stage of his life. And he saw him, you know, he saw what he did at Rome when the light heavyweight title. And that was a springboard to, of course, his great career as a boxer. But one thing that kept Jerry and Muhammad Ali so close was the fact that Jerry covered so many of his fights. And he spent time at training camp, days upon days, through the 60s, through the 70s. So for his entire pro career, Jerry was around. And this involves many countries. You know, this involves, of course, going to Florida when he trained in Miami to fight Sonny Liston. This involves going years later to the Philippines for the Thrill in Manila and the fight against George Foreman in Kinshasa. So Jerry had been around Muhammad Ali through the highs of his career and also during the lows. That's an important point. When other people did not agree with his decision to become a Black Muslim, Nation of Islam follower, change his name to Muhammad Ali, and refuse to be drafted into the military, Jerry respected those decisions and said, this is America, this is your right to do these things. And it was an unpopular stand that he took. But I don't know how many of those columns that Muhammad Ali read, but you know, word certainly got to him that this is what Jerry's stand, this is the stand Jerry's taking. But I think also when Muhammad Ali heard the questions that Jerry was asking, he sort of realized what he was writing about.
Sure.
Now, as far as their friendship goes, one thing that made Muhammad Ali so different than a lot of other athletes, I guess you could say, is the availability of him for access. He had handlers. Yes, he had a management team. He had a lot of people that were hangers-on. He had Angelo Dundee as his trainer. He had Bundini as his kind of like a guru, spiritual cheerleader. But Muhammad Ali loved having people around him. He loved having people, he loved the attention. So I guess one thing that Jerry was always there, and that helped them become close friends. And their friendship had ups and downs, and Jerry did not agree with Muhammad Ali coming out of retirement, for example, to fight Larry Holmes in the late 70s, or to fight Trevor Burbick at the end as well. So he criticized him, and he told him, this is damaging your health. This is risky. He told him stuff he didn't want to hear as well. He wasn't just a sycophant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. But through it all, they remained friends up until Ali's passing in 2016. Hey, let me ask you this. Let's get back to his real job, writing for the Newark Star-Ledger.
Yeah.
How do you think writing for that paper instead of a New York Times, a New York Daily News, a Washington Post, how do you think that might have negatively affected his notoriety?
I think if he was at the New York Times, he would have probably won a Pulitzer Prize. So that would have carried prestige throughout the latter half of his life. Probably he would have won a Pulitzer back in the 70s or 80s. I'll give you another example. A year after Roberto Clemente passed away in 72 in a plane crash on a humanitarian mission from Puerto Rico to Nicaragua after the devastating earthquake, right?
Sure.
And a year after that, Jerry, the 1 year anniversary of that, of his death, he flew down to where the plane, the closest spot of where the plane had crashed along the coast to Puerto Rico. And he did a documentary about that. And he also wrote columns about it. And 30 years after his passing, he also went back again and retraced the arc of Clemente's life, his humanitarian mission, his family's legacy, of the legacy that his family carried on, and how there was a sports complex and a charity and all these things that the family focused on to honor their Roberto's name. I don't know how many reporters went back 30 years later, but Jerry was one of the few, I'm pretty sure. And so he utilized his understanding of what are the biggest stories. And this carried him beyond the Newark Star-Ledger. But I think he probably would have won a Pulitzer if the New York Times had been behind, advocating for it. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes the institutions that are more national, they influence the judges a bit, the voters a bit more,
Well, I don't want to give everything away, but it is certainly addressed. A Pulitzer Prize is certainly addressed in your book. And Jerry had some pretty interesting comments, some colorful comments about it. But let's leave that little nugget for the people who want to read your book. What I want to know is, man with Jerry's talent for writing, why did he choose to write about sports instead of news or politics or the issues of the day? Why did Jerry Eisenberg find writing about sports so important?
Okay. Well, one thing I did not mention in the book, but one thing that really resonated with him when he was in high school was his English teacher in high school, who also served as a basketball coach in Newark. They were having a conversation one day, and it came to careers. And Jerry said, I probably don't want to go to college, but I like sports. I want to write about, I like sports. And his teacher said something to the effect of, you know, you should write about what you know. And Jerry's father was a former minor league baseball player and semi-pro player in different stages of his adult life. And baseball was really big in his childhood. It really affected him as far as what he was interested in at a young age. And his approach to writing, part of it was he liked to explore what made people, like how people overcame struggles, how they overcame obstacles in life, but using the daily performance of a game or a match or a, like one round of a golf tournament, though, that was a way of him to explore those things.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Eisenberg wasn't just another sports writer, was he? I mean, as Jim Lampley said, he didn't make himself a part of the story or a story period. What he was writing about was the story. He just happened to pen it. How should Jerry Eisenberg be recognized? What should we know about Jerry, respect about Jerry? And when the unfortunate day comes that Jerry is no longer with us, how should Jerry Eisenberg be remembered?
He should be remembered as a few things: a great humanitarian, a prolific columnist, a great stylist. He should be remembered for using the platform of a column to tell stories that will resonate decades after they're written. You go back and look at what he wrote in the 1960s about race relations, about boxing, about baseball, some of the issues that Roger Maris dealt with in his life. These are things that still matter today. If you're researching a topic, you'll want to go to him as one of the first people you look at. So I think he's in the short conversation among the last the last 75 years or so of sports reporters, sports columnists, because you got to even start in the 50s. Early in his career, he was also writing great stuff, and it really picked up when he became a full-time columnist in 1962. But before that, interrupted by the Korean War, he had been writing some really good stuff in his early 20s.
Well, you cover so much of it in your book, Going 15 Rounds with Jerry Eisenberg. And I encourage everybody who's listening to today's podcast to get a copy of Going 15 Rounds with Jerry Eisenberg. There is so much we didn't get into. You know, the fact that boxing might just be his favorite sport. He loved horse racing. The other writers who spoke about him, the other issues that he fought for. I mean, what a life, what a career that Jerry Eisenberg had. Ed, how can people get a hold of Going 15 Rounds with Jerry Eisenberg?
Okay. I've got a press release on my website, edodevinreporting.com. And maybe you can put the link on your the podcast.
Most definitely.
I'm selling the book at this point through ebook channels, primarily Barnes & Noble, Apple Books, PayHip, which is a direct to sale format, Google Play Books. I'm working on getting a few other companies to have it in their online marketplace, but Barnes & Noble and Apple Books are the two main ones, I think, and for e-readers and just e-book formats.
I will encourage everybody, and I do encourage everybody to find it. I will list it on my website, sportsfh.com. And of course, I always post about my guests and the books that they write on my Facebook page, on
Thank you.
Twitter, on Instagram. Ed, all the way from Tokyo, Japan, thank you for stopping by to join me on Sports Forgotten Heroes to talk about a true treasure when it comes to sports writing, Jerry Eisenberg. Ed, thank you so much for being here. So I want to again thank my guest today, Ed Odevin, for sharing so much with us about Jerry. You can find his book, Going 15 Rounds with Jerry Eisenberg, anywhere you get your ebooks, like Barnes & Noble, Apple Books, again, anywhere you get ebooks. And you can visit Ed's site at edodevinreporting.com. That's edodevinreporting.com. edodevinreporting.com. Next on Sports Forgotten Heroes, I will be taking a look back at a remarkable career on the ice, a career that has been overlooked for so long, a career that probably should have ended with a Hall of Fame induction, and sadly, a life that recently came to an end. Join me as I talk with the great Vic Hadfield and the family of Jim Nielsen as I take a look back at Jim's terrific career as a defenseman with the New York Rangers. For now, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes.